Today is Thorough Thursday. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. On Thorough Thursday, I talk with experts providing you with in-depth information about a single subject.
And I am very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Dale Archer, who is a psychiatrist, a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. He is a native of New Orleans and a graduate of Tulane and the University of Texas, and he founded the Institute for Neuropsychology in Lake Charles. Lake Charles where, Dr. Archer?
Lake Charles, Louisiana, and actually it's the Institute for Neuropsychiatry.
Oh, what did I say?
Psychology.
I changed the name of your organization.
Yes.
What can What can I tell you?
Yeah, that's okay. A lot of people don't know the difference anyway. So I think for the general public, it's probably the same thing.
It was okay. Well, again, welcome. I'm very pleased to have you here with us today on Mind Talk. You have written a book. You've written many books, but you've written a book that we're going to talk about today, which is going to, as I know you know, turn some seasoned clinicians on their ear, politely speaking. The name of your book is The ADHD Advantage: What You Thought Was a Diagnosis May Be Your Greatest Strength. The reason that I say it will turn many seasoned clinicians on their ear is because you talk about the fact that medication may not be the needed cure-all, end-all, be-all for persons who have been diagnosed with ADHD.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And, you know, when you look at 3.5 million kids between the ages of 5 and 17 taking medication, including 10,000 2- to 3-year-olds, with the RX rate up about fivefold over the last 15 years, then you have to start scratching your head and say, wow, are we going to medicate everyone? I mean, with close to 20% of teenage boys having the ADHD diagnosis, 11% of kids 5 to 17. So I think it's a self-made epidemic. And unfortunately, the so-called cure for this epidemic, the treatment, is considered a pill. And I think there are two aspects to that that are problematic. Number one is the fact that there are multiple treatments out there that work very well for ADHD, from the classroom to parental training to individual therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, ADHD coaching. All of those are known to be very, very effective. And oftentimes they're not even considered. And then number two, which is, of course, what my book is about, is the fact that, look, yes, ADHD has problems that go along with it, but there are a host of advantages which no one is talking about. And so I think you're absolutely right. There will be a lot of people up in arms. There already are. In fact, some of the feedback I've received to this point, I mean, I have very fervent supporters saying it's about time somebody acknowledges this. But then I've got the very pro-medication crowd who are saying, how can you stigmatize this and take meds away from people that it really helps? So my stance is, look, I'm not opposed to meds in severe cases after other treatments have failed. I am opposed to meds being a knee-jerk first treatment right out of the box for someone who receives an ADHD diagnosis.
All right, let's back up a tiny bit, and I'm going to ask you to explain to the audience what ADHD means. And for many folks listening, they're used to hearing ADD, not so much ADHD.
So the best way to understand it is to explain what those letters mean. So ADD was really the first diagnosis. It came out in 1980 in the DSM-3, the third manual of psychiatric diagnosis. And that name was changed in the 90s to ADHD. So ADD, attention deficit disorder, it used to have two subtypes, either with or without hyperactivity. They realized it was all part of the same diagnosis, whether you had the hyperactivity or not. So then they changed it in the 90s to ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Interestingly, with ADHD, you don't have to have the hyperactivity to have the diagnosis. But essentially, it is problems with attention.
Okay.
You can't focus. You can't concentrate. You procrastinate. You get bored easily. You often will use the hyperactivity when you get bored. So the hyperactivity is often a symptom of a bored brain. But trouble with focus, concentration, attention is what ADHD is all about. And of course, that those are the negatives that have been talked about ad nauseum. I mean, everyone knows what the symptoms include, but once again, they don't talk about the positives.
Well, but you know, as you describe the symptoms, I mean, it's certainly pretty clear why teachers certainly would sort of be pulling their hair out if they've got somebody who is easily distractible, they're sort of impulsive. If they get bored, they just sort of go off the rails and just pay attention to do other things. I mean, you can see why teachers would say, oh, please give me a pill.
Sure. And the number one predictor of who gets the meds are indeed teachers. And look, there's a whole host of reasons why this ADHD epidemic has burst upon us. And so, I mean, obviously for big pharma, there's big bucks in the treatment. You've got teachers that are overwhelmed with an average of 35 students per class.
Yeah.
Of course, you can see that they can't handle any type of behavioral discontrol from one or two because it disrupts the whole class. You've got parents that are stressed out and having trouble with their child. You've got our pop a pill psychiatry where, you know, and back when I trained, we got equal parts psychotherapy versus biologic medication training. And nowadays, a lot of psychiatric residents get very little psychotherapy training. And then finally, you've got our microwave culture where we want a quick fix. We want it now. And we don't want to put the time and the effort and the trouble into going to therapy and doing the techniques that we know are very effective. So going back to the teachers, the problem is, yeah, you can see why the teachers are stressed out when they have kids like this.
Sure.
But there are many different techniques that work with these kids. And number one is, of course, if you look at it as being bored easily, which is what the ADHD brain is and the easiest way to understand it, then find ways to activate and excite and get these kids interested and involved. And there are many schools out there that are doing it. Unfortunately, they're expensive and they're private, but they're having tremendous success. And we're hoping to get that pushed into the public school system so that there will be an ADHD tract that the kids will be in, as opposed to being forced to sit in a classroom like everyone else and behave and pay attention and do your work.
Well, let's talk about some of the really negative myths that get tacked on to ADHD. I mean, certainly one of them is with that diagnosis, you have to have medication, period, end of story. What are some of the other myths?
You know, I don't know that myth is the right word, but when you have a diagnosis that has those two D words, deficit and disorder, that implies that you're very sick. And unfortunately, the connotation that goes along with ADHD is often every bit as severe and as damaging to these kids as the symptoms of the diagnosis itself. So you're broken, you're not going to be normal, you need to take a pill to be normal, you're going to have trouble the rest of your life, you're never going to fit in, you're going to have trouble with focus and concentration, on and on and on. Those are the stigmas that are piled on top of the diagnosis. And I would just like for people to say, okay, yeah, these are some of the downsides, but you're going to be great at multitasking. You have creative thinking. You're going to be able to have hyper-focus on things that you really like. You're going to be athletic more so than the general population. You're going to have high energy. You're going to have more charisma. There, on and on and on, there are a lot of positives here that we need to tell the child at the same time when they're receiving this ADHD news, and the parents as well. These are the downsides, but these are the good things.
And I don't think that I've ever heard of a parent or even a clinician giving the rest of the story when that diagnosis is offered.
No, I think it's very uncommon, and I think that Well, I mean, my book is the first book that's ever been devoted to strictly talking about the advantages of ADHD. So there have been dozens, if not hundreds, of the books written about ADHD dating back to the late 80s all the way till now. And so I think that explains it right there. And you know, a lot of this is really cutting-edge research. So there are research studies now that are coming out and saying, wait a minute, you know, Major League Baseball players have twice the adult incident as the general population.
Interesting.
There could well be a Olympic Sports Hall of Fame for the ADHD-er. Michael Phelps, of course, being the classic example, mm-hmm. the prime example, mm-hmm. who struggled tremendously throughout his entire childhood, was put on medication for a while, begged his mother to take him off, finally found salvation in the pool where he excelled, and of course was able to hyper-focus on that because it was the only thing he was good at. And so while everyone else was living a normal teenage life, Michael found relief in the pool, so was able to practice longer and harder and more because he was good at it and because it enabled him to be successful at something. So resilience is another one that's not talked about. Mm, there's a
true.
Recent study out of Elon College down in North Carolina which found that ADHD college students, not on meds, are more resilient across the board than non-ADHDers. So the evidence is just starting to trickle in, and I look at it, my role is to say, look, let's make the conversation equal. We'll talk about the problems, but we want to talk about the advantages also.
So when a parent gets this, or a child, when anyone gets this diagnosis, rather than seeing it as a lifelong opportunity to take medication and feel badly about yourself, you're saying, look at the fullness of what this diagnosis really means, and let's figure out what the next best steps are, which may or may not be medication.
Right. I mean, there needs to be an order to things. And so the first thing I would tell parents is that when you have a child that has ADHD symptoms, the hyperactivity, the impulsivity, the poor focus, the poor concentration, on and on and on, then typically the school will be coming to you saying, we're having problems with your son,
right.
And it's usually a boy, so I say son, and he can't sit still in class, he doesn't do his assignments, he's disruptive, he's not learning, he's not, grades are bad, and we recommend you go to this doctor, the school doctor, and typically the school doctor will do a quick assessment based on the teacher's report, mm-hmm. and he gets slapped with an ADHD diagnosis. So the first thing I say is, you need to make sure you're going to a specialist for that diagnosis. Not a pediatrician, not a family practitioner,
okay.
rather either a child psychologist or psychiatrist that specializes in ADHD to make sure you're getting an accurate diagnosis.
Okay.
Once the diagnosis is made, the next thing you need to do is you want to talk about non-medication treatments. What type of therapy is available? How can we restructure his homework regimen? What about the school system? What can be done within the classroom? Because ADHDers, for example, are hands-on learners. We do much better in hands-on situations than sitting and being lectured to. And this can play a big role in homework as well.
Mm-hmm.
Family therapy, parental training, individual therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy with the child, self-esteem therapy to work with the negative connotations. All of these things are very effective, and in the mild to moderate cases, they're often all that's needed. And then my advice is, if you go for a year and nothing seems to work, then you can consider meds. But in addition to all of this, and this is going to be hard to find because no one else is talking about it, you do need to understand that with this trait and with the disadvantages, there are a host of advantages as well. And, of course, in my book, I give example after example and interview after interview of very successful people who have become successful in their minds, not in spite of their ADHD, but because of their ADHD.
Interesting. And I notice, Dr. Archer, as you're talking about ADHD, you've said we. Sounds like this is something that you have personal experience with.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was a very rambunctious child, and I think the thing that saved me is that the ADHD diagnosis didn't exist when I went to school. I was in grade school back in the 60s and early 70s, graduated from high school in 74. But, you know, we spoke about resilience, and I think one of the things that those of us with the ADHD brain learn early on is that we have to figure out our own way of being able to deal with the way our brain works. And I don't think of it as a disability or a disorder. I like to think of it as a difference, a learning difference. Mm-hmm. We learn differently. And so for me, I found that I was able to pick up bits and pieces from the teacher of what were the most important aspects of whatever subject I was in. And mm-hmm. once I felt I had a grasp of it, then to keep from getting in trouble, I always sat in the back of the class. I would take a nap. So I was able to go to sleep. Otherwise, I would get sent to the principals. And, of course, in those days, we got paddled and for being a bad kid. And I got tired of that. So I figured out my own coping strategy, which worked well. But, yeah, I definitely have – I'm an ADHDer and have dealt with it for many, many years.
Dr. Archer, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, you have mentioned a couple of times the different kinds of therapy that are available to assist those with this diagnosis, and I'd like to pick up with going through those in a little bit more detail for folks who may not be clear as to what it is you're actually talking about. We're going to take a break, folks, and we will be right back and continue the conversation with Dr. Dale Archer. Don't go away, folks. Dr. Archer, you've spoken a couple of times about therapy that involves parental training. And, you know, we know that a lot of times when there are what parents perceive to be challenging children in the household, they don't want to think about themselves as having to do something different. There's a tendency to blame the child for being unruly, lazy, you name it. So when you talk about parental training, particularly with the children who may have this diagnosis, what exactly are you talking about? You're blaming the parents? Are you telling them what they did wrong? What's it about?
No, I'm certainly not blaming the parents. And I think that it needs to be clear that when you have a child and they have a condition such as ADHD, with both the pros and the cons, very often the parents don't understand it. So it's important for the parent to have an understanding of what the condition is, what the challenges will be, and how to deal with these challenges in an appropriate manner. So essentially, in a nutshell, that's what it is. It's not, I think that sometimes we tend to give too much credence to the particular type of therapy, interpersonal therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, self-esteem training. At the end of the day, it boils down to understanding the condition, understanding what goes into it, and understanding your role as a parent and what you can do in order to maximize the strengths and minimize the weaknesses. And the therapy goes even beyond that. I think therapy can be very effective for the adult ADHDer as well. And of course, a whole industry has sprung up called ADHD coaching, where the coaches, often ADHDers themselves, have learned their own tricks, strategies, and techniques that work very well, and then they will impart these to adults. So I think that the therapy can be effective across the board. What type of therapy is probably not as important, because some of the nuances are very, very difficult for the non-therapist to understand.
Okay.
But in a nutshell, that's what we're talking about.
When you said earlier that the diagnosis tends to be attached to boys more often than girls, what's your view of what that's about?
Well, it's very simple. Boys tend to be more hyperactive than girls in general, and so therefore when they have the ADHD diagnosis, the hyperactivity is, of course, what draws all the attention to the child, and then that triggers the treatment. So, you know, ADHD in girls, at one point it was considered that it really didn't exist in girls, if we go back 30 years.
Interesting.
And, of course, today we understand that the symptoms are just different. Girls are much less likely to have the hyperactivity. And more likely, it seems, the research is starting to show now that they are being possibly misdiagnosed with depression or with anxiety, when in reality they have ADHD traits underlying that. And because the hyperactivity isn't there, the diagnosis is missed. So it's fascinating that I do talk about women. I have women examples in my book, and I have women interviews in my book. And I've been applauded by many women reaching out saying, yes, I've had it, but no one acknowledges that there's a problem in women. There needs to be a book written strictly for women about it. Mm. And I would agree with that. I think it is under-recognized in women. But on the other hand, the good news about that is that the women tend less to be medicated.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the bad news is they may go along with a misdiagnosis thinking that they're depressed. In reality, they've got ADHD, and they're often left to figure things out on their own, which is often the case for many ADHDers. We have to figure out, hey, how does my brain work? How can I maximize the things that I do well? And it's trial and error along the way.
Give us an example of some of the folks that you wrote about in the ADHD Advantage, and just what their lives were like.
Well, we'll break it down by categories. First of all, I interviewed a whole host of individuals. So there were the very famous people. Howie Mandel, for example, was a wonderful interview and kept me laughing for well over 2 hours. It was supposed to be a 30-minute interview. But he, of course, has OCD as well as ADHD. But he is able to recognize ADHD as a strength that of his that led to his success as a comedian. He was working in a furniture store when he did stand-up comedy one night just on an impulse, and the audience loved him, and he decided on the spot, of course, being an ADHDer, we are very impulsive, but I call it functional impulsivity.
There you go.
Decided on the spot that's what he wanted to do, and, of course, the rest is history. Ty Pennington is another one. In terms of the CEO realm, you've got Richard Branson, David Neilman. David Neilman was also a great interview. He's the CEO and founder, of course, of Azul Airlines in Brazil, but he's best known in the U.S. for founding JetBlue.
Mm-hmm.
And David had horrible ADHD when he was a child. In fact, we had a great conversation. He was going, I couldn't even write a sentence. I was so antsy. I couldn't focus for more than 5 minutes at a time. And he goes, but when I got older and fell in love with airplanes and the airline industry, I was able to hyper-focus for days and weeks on end about how to do it better, what was wrong with it. I just fell in love with it. He goes, how could a brain like mine that was so scattered and couldn't even concentrate in a class for more than 5 to 10 minutes at a time, how could that brain be the same brain that could focus on the airline industry for years and years and years and love it the whole time? And so, of course, the key is the hyperfocus, which in the ADHD brain, since we are bored easily, when we do find something that we love and are fascinated with, it flips a switch, and we are able to hyperfocus on that. And I hear that over and over and over, the people I interviewed. I found my calling. I found what I love. And all of a sudden, you know, the rest was so easy. Bobby Chen, the great celebrity chef, worked in 40 different jobs, never even cooked before, all of a sudden ended up in a restaurant as a busboy, got into the kitchen, fell in love with it, and he said, without that, he goes, I don't know what I would have ended up, but I found my love and was able to hyper-focus and do well. Of course, Michael Phelps we've talked about.
Sure.
And then there's the regular people. There's small-town doctor Mike Watson, who tried a variety of different aspects of medicine, and finally realized he liked being just a general family doctor doing a little bit of everything. That was his calling. So the list goes on and on and on. And it was just the best part of the book, being able to talk to these people and hear them all say, thank goodness for my ADHD. David Neeleman said, if I could take a pill to make it go away, or be told by magic you can either live your life with this trait or without, I would choose the ADHD. It has given me so much.
That's interesting. And, you know, I think it just opens up so much hope for folks who have been children, adults, parents, who have been walking around for years with the cloud, if you will, of ADHD, and seeing it as proof that they can't do. And what you talk about are all the things that they can do, and they can do exceptionally well.
No, you're right. And I think, you know, it's interesting because some of the hardcore medication proponents have been very aggressive in bashing me for saying I am stigmatizing people that need to take meds. And, you know, back 30 years ago when I was practicing psychiatry, there was a stigma against psychiatric diagnosis and against psychiatric medication.
Right.
And back in those days, we were fighting hard to say, look, you know, this is a chemical imbalance of the brain. Medications work. But the pendulum has swung so far. Psychiatry went from being stigmatized to glamorized. And now I don't see anybody who comes in who has any stigma about taking a med. If anything, it's the exact opposite. They want to take a med. That's why they're coming in. And I think the stigma now is in terms of the ADHDer needs to be on medication, and otherwise they're not going to function normally. Mm-hmm. Whereas what we need to tell them is, yeah, if you can figure out what your strengths are and build your life around your strengths and build your life around those traits and not focus on the negative but focus on the positive, you can have an extremely successful life. And here's 50 people in my book who have done it, and this is how they've done it.
So, again, there's just so much hope, and there's so much of an opening up in terms of how to think about what, as we've been saying, for years has been thought of as almost a curse.
I think that is a perfect description. It has been thought of as a curse.
You quote Dr. Keith Connors as being among the first physicians to legitimize ADHD as a diagnosis. And very recently, apparently he said that the surge in diagnosis and prescription rates with respect to ADHD is, quote, a national disaster of dangerous proportions. That's pretty stunning.
Keith, Dr. Connors has come out with that. Alan Francis, who wrote the foreword in my book, who was a prominent psychiatrist involved in both the DSM-3 and also the head of the DSM-4 task force, has come out strongly and saying we've made terrible mistakes, that this is an epidemic of our own making, and the over-medication in psychiatry is a national disaster. So I think that gradually psychiatrists are starting to come out and say, this has got to stop. When NIMH comes out with a recent stat saying 25% of Americans have a diagnosable psychiatric illness, one in four, that even either says that we're a totally broken society and that everyone has got a psychiatric problem, or that we are over-diagnosing and over-treating, and unfortunately, those two equate to over-medication for treatment, and it needs to stop. So I think that the pendulum is starting to swing back, and prominent physicians are now coming out and saying, stop, wait, we can't be giving a pill for everything. A little bit of anxiety, a little bit of depression, a little bit of poor focus doesn't mean you need to take a pill. So it's a huge problem, and fortunately, there's some lone voices in the wilderness now that are starting to speak up, and hopefully we can start a trend.
You know, as you're talking about the sort of addiction to giving medication, I have to think about insurance companies, and I have to think about certainly the pharmaceutical houses. When we come back, let's sort of dive into that whole piece a little bit more, if you would.
That sounds good.
All right. Well, folks, we will be right back. This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to a conversation with Dr. Dale Archer, who is the author of The ADHD Advantage, What You Thought Was a Diagnosis May Be Your Greatest Strength. Don't go away. We'll return in a moment. Dr. Archer, I'd like to ask you, when you decided that you wanted to go into medicine and that you wanted to focus on psychiatry, what were your goals for yourself as a clinician? What did you see yourself as doing?
Well, it's interesting. I did not see myself as a psychiatrist, first off. And when I was in medical school, I was most interested at that point in clinical research. And I worked as a moonlighting job as a clinical research assistant in the clinical research center right next to Tulane University, and really enjoyed that, fell in love with it, and actually had a open spot for me after I went and did a residency. I could come back and do it. Well, I got into residency and started in internal medicine, didn't really care for it that much, and went through a lot of soul searching. So ended up deciding on psychiatry because I was fascinated with how the brain worked. And I was fascinated with the fact that back in the 80s, when I was doing my training, that psychiatric medications were just starting to come into acceptance. There was Xanax and Prozac, probably the big two back then. And so I was thinking then that, wow, we're going to be able to treat everything with a pill, and this is a brave new world, and what a great movement to be part of. Well, of course, I became part of it, and then watched in horror as a pill went from being stigmatized and no one wanted to take it to people started coming in the office asking for exactly what they wanted, and realized a few years ago that things had gone much too far.
What is your sense of what, if any, impact insurance, managed care, all of that has had on the growth of the use of medication in psychiatry?
I think it has had a huge amount to do with that. And, you know, I look back when I started my private practice in psychiatry in the 80s, then there was a big movement then where insurers came on board and said, look, all these people are going through psychoanalysis. It's $100 an hour, four times a week, going on for years, and that's ridiculous. We're only going to pay for the sickest of the sick. We're only going to pay for people that are sick enough to need psychiatric hospitalization. So there was a period then where if you had an outpatient psychiatric problem that didn't require hospitalization, your insurance wouldn't pay for it. But if you got put in the hospital, they would. So, of course, everyone ended up getting put in the hospital. Otherwise, they couldn't afford treatment, even though they really didn't need to be there. Gotcha. It was the only way they could afford to get it paid. Well, the insurers, of course, realized that, wait a minute, I mean, the percent of the healthcare budget in America spiked, went from 2% up to over 20%, and they realized that they had a problem there, so then they cut back. The net result in all of that is that by far the cheapest and most cost-effective way to treat people is with a pill. because you don't have to pay for ongoing sessions. They get a diagnosis, they're put on a pill, and then the treating doc will see them maybe every 3 to 6 months after that.
Right.
Whereas therapy would be once a week and it would be ongoing. And so I think that that's a huge part of the problem. It's certainly not the only part of the problem, but it is part of the problem.
Now, there was a time when I was actually taking insurance, which I don't do anymore. But during that period of time, if there were certain diagnoses that you knew you were supposed to refer them for a psychiatric evaluation, and if for some reason they refused the evaluation or refused to take the medication, they ran the risk of losing insurance coverage for that issue being deemed by the insurance company as being non-compliant. Does that still exist? Do you know?
I don't think it exists to the point where they would be refused coverage.
Okay.
And, of course, as a psychiatrist, I don't know what's going on with the family practitioners, whether they're getting that. We do have people that are referred for family practice docs, but typically it's after they've tried a couple of things that hadn't worked, they throw up their hands and say, you need to see a psychiatrist because mm-hmm. we're not getting you any better. The problem there is that the overwhelming bulk of psychiatric meds are not written by psychiatrists.
Right.
They're written by the general practitioners, right. the family practitioners, the pediatricians, the OBGYNs. Those are the ones who establish the rapport with the patient, and those are the ones who treat the bulk of psychiatric conditions. So before they end up coming to see a psychiatrist, they need to have failed that treatment mm-hmm. and or be doing very, very poorly. And so then they get sent to us. And the big problem in the whole scheme is that family practitioners, general practitioners, pediatricians, OBGYNs, they don't have therapists as a rule on staff. They don't have an option of saying, you know what, you do have some depression, but you don't need to take a pill. You can see this therapist, have some therapy. Usually that works, and then you'll do fine. If you don't have that option, then all you have to offer the patient is a pill,
gotcha.
And so that's what they get. When they come to see me, I have a full-service mental health clinic. We have psychologists and therapists and technicians, and we have a whole host of treatment we can refer them into. But the gatekeepers, the guys who are seeing the folks first, do not have those options as a general rule, and so I think that's another reason that medication has skyrocketed.
You were saying earlier that you would rather see a child who's been given the diagnosis of ADHD trying, the child and the family trying many different options, and after a year, if things aren't significantly improved, then consider medication. Did I hear you correctly?
Yes, that's typically my advice when I'm involved in a case that has a child that's part of it, is that, look, try these other options first and then consider the meds. But I will also say that in my clinic, since it's a psychiatric clinic, very, very often by the time the child gets here,
mm-hmm.
they're already on meds and they've been on meds for a long time. So that whole step is really never given as an option to the parents, strictly because oftentimes the child is being put on the meds by a non-psychiatrist. They're being, put by their family doctor.
Well, and I would also think that, let's say the child is not on medication and comes to you, but the parent is having challenges, the school's having challenges, the child is having challenges. The idea of waiting 365 days before resorting to medication, I would think with that kind of advice that you'd get a fair amount of pushback from some parents. I mean, there's some parents who would really appreciate the fact that you're not trying to put their child on a pill before they walk out the door. But for some parents, I would think that would be a horrifying thought, a whole year of this, a year more of this.
Yeah, it's different in every case. And so, of course, you have some parents who are totally anti-meds and they want to do everything possible to keep their child from being put on meds. You have other parents that are so stressed out with their lives and their day-to-day routine that they don't have time to devote to the type of therapy that we would recommend. So it just depends. Some are very pro-meds. They come in, they've done all the research, they've tried some things on their own that haven't worked. So there's definitely not a one-size-fits-all, and you have to take each case and evaluate it separately. But at the end of the day, the message is, it's not really the year that's important. The message is, there are things that can be done that don't require a pill. And mm-hmm. even if you do take the pill, then consider holidays on weekends and take them off during the summer. And understand that as they get older, that very often the symptoms diminish and you don't need the medications for life. You can get off of it. So there are a whole battery of things that have to be taken into consideration. And I think that the important thing is just not to have that knee-jerk mm-hmm. diagnosis, medication, end of story, without at least putting some effort into exploring options.
Talk a little bit more about the medication holidays and the idea that you may not have to take the medication for a lifetime. Tell us more about that.
Well, I think that a good example from my book is Mark Neelman, who is David Neelman's partner in Azul Airlines down in Brazil. He's an entrepreneur, much like his brother David. And so Mark, of course, runs a variety of businesses. He's an entrepreneur. And he's come up with a strategy where he has severe ADHD and has his whole life. He loves the creativity that flows when he's not taking meds and the new ideas that are generated for new companies and all of the things that he loves to do. But he also recognizes that he is running several businesses, and in order to do that, he can't do that totally when he is in ADHD mode. So he takes his meds 3 days a week, and Mark's in his 30s. And so Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, he does all the routine, boring things that he doesn't want to do, but he has to do in order to run a business. And then he does the creative, fun stuff, the hyper-focus, the multitasking, all the things that he loves to do. He does that the rest of the week. So the message is that you can be flexible and tailor a regimen to what works for you. But time and time again, I hear from these folks, these successful ADHDers, that when they take the med, they lose a little bit of their edge. They lose their creativity, their nonlinear thinking. They lose a lot of the inherent strengths that go along with the ADHD continuum. And so they either don't take them or they take them a little bit here and there as needed. The message being, just because you do need meds and nothing else has worked for you, doesn't mean you need them all the time, doesn't mean you're going to need them forever, and you always want to be open to that. So the medication holidays are a way for individuals, children, parents, and adults, to see how they're focusing and doing without, and one day you may find, you know what, I really don't need that anymore. So that's the message there. So the message is, you know, if you can get by without the meds, why would you take the meds? Why take them if you don't need them? And the only way you're going to know whether you need them or not is to have periods of time when you don't take them and see how you do.
There are negative side effects to pretty much every pill that exists. That may be a slight overstatement, but probably not by much. What are some of the side effects of the medications? And I know there are lots of different medications now that are out for ADHD, but in general, are there some generalized side effects that you can identify that may cause folks some trouble?
Well, I think probably the two big ones would be, number one, insomnia, and then number two, the anxiety and loss of appetite. So, and the loss of appetite is particularly important in children because, you know, there are studies that show that they don't gain as much weight, they don't grow as much. There is a little bit of problems in the growth rate of kids that are taking the stimulants as opposed to not. So, you know, those are the well-known ones. But now studies are starting to come out and saying, look, These meds act on the dopamine system in the brain, and dopamine, of course, is the not only the chemical, neurochemical that allows us to focus and concentrate, but it's also the chemical that is part of our pleasure reward system in the brain. So it gives us that euphoria when we do something that we really enjoy, something that's fun, like the runner's high is related to dopamine, for example. Doing pleasurable activities triggers a dopamine release. And the theory now is that are we resetting the thermostat in the brain of these people that take the meds such that they aren't going to experience pleasure in the same way that other people do, because we are constantly using a synthetic dopamine, i.e. the stimulant, in the brain. And so this is really early. There's no definitive results on that, but it does beg the question that, yeah, all these meds do have side effects. And of course, other medications that work in the pleasure reward center of the brain and affect dopamine would be cocaine and methamphetamine. You know, some of these powerful, dangerous, illegal drugs work along the same pathways. So these are things that we don't have an answer for yet, but certainly they're things that we have to be aware of and concerned about, especially in long-term treatment.
Dr. Archer, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to pick up with what, if any, causes or genetic factors have been identified with ADHD. Folks, Pamela Brewer, you're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be back in a minute. Dr. Archer, are there any identifiable causes or genetic factors that point to ADHD?
ADHD is absolutely genetic, and you look no further than identical twin studies where you've got a greater than 80% occurrence rate when one of the twins has it as opposed to the other one. So, you know, it goes all the way down in terms of the more you have it in your family, the greater likelihood you're going to have it. And of course, it's related to the dopamine system, as I said. In particular, there are a couple of dopamine-related genes, the dopamine transporter gene and the dopamine receptor gene. What all this means, and this is a lot of neuroscience talk, which is probably difficult to understand, but to explain it simply, the dopamine system, the pleasure reward concentration system in the ADHDer has a lower tone than in other folks. And one great example to understand this is a fantastic study that was done a few years back through UC Irvine. And what they did was they looked around the world and did a genetic sampling of native populations and looked at these dopamine variants, these dopamine gene variations. And they found that at the far reaches of the planet, in Alaska, Siberia, Tierra del Fuego, Australia, as far away as you could get from what was at the time the civilized world, they found that in these populations, a preponderance of these dopamine genes affiliated with ADHD. And they coined the term the explorer gene to recognize that these were the restless souls who got bored with prehistoric village life and wanted to go out and explore the world, and they ended up as far away from everything as they could possibly be. So I think the Explorer gene sums up the genetics of ADHD. And it also sums up kind of an understanding of what we ADHDers would rather be doing. We would rather be out exploring and seeing the world and seeing new lands and developing new businesses and ideas and techniques, as opposed to living the routine, standard, status quo existence, which the other 90% of the population does. So, of course, in a modern society, both types of people are important, but we don't want to take 10% of the population and say, you're not like everyone else, we're going to give you a pill to make you normal. That's not the answer. The answer is, we want to find ways for you to maximize these strengths. And it will be as an entrepreneur, as a creative thinker, as doing something new and different. That's where your niche is.
Which really moves society forward.
It absolutely moves society forward. And I think it's just a terrible mistake that we are labeling this as a disorder in need of a fix and telling parents and kids and adults, of course, you know, the rate is 5% of adults now. So adults aren't far behind kids in terms of the diagnostic rate. But we're telling them, you are not normal. And in order to be normal, we're going to give you this pill and it'll make you just like everybody else.
So in order to be normal, you have to be the same.
Yeah, right. And you have to take a pill to be normal. So, yeah.
You offer information. There's a comment that you make in the book where you say state-by-state variability. I'm now quoting from your book, so you may recognize the language. State-by-state variability ranges from 5.6% in Nevada to 15.6% in North Carolina. And you ask the question, why do three times more kids in North Carolina have ADHD than in Nevada? Is it the water? Is it the desert? What is it? What's your thought? What is it?
Well, you know, interestingly, the revision of that study just came out just within the last couple of months. And sad to say that my home state of Louisiana has moved above North Carolina to 15.8%. So now Louisiana is the number one state in the nation with a diagnostic rate of almost 16%. Nevada's held relatively stable.
So maybe it is the water or the air?
The desert. The
okay.
Desert's a cure.
Okay.
The bayou, the Louisiana bayou somehow triggers it, and then you go to the desert and you get cured.
There you go.
Now, I think that you know, look, it gets even worse when you look internationally. You look at a rate in the UK below 5% and France down below 2%. Now, in some studies, France is at 0.5%. Of course, in France, they only recognize it when it's severe enough to require medication, and those standards are very, very different than here. But at the end of the day, what this tells you is that the diagnostic standards are immensely variable.
Yeah.
And so how can you have a real diagnosis where you have three times the diagnosis in one state as opposed to another? You don't see that in any other diagnostic category, heart disease, cancer. That's consistent across the United States. Well, ADHD is diagnosed by a checklist of symptoms. You've got the DSM-5, you've got 9 symptoms. You have 6 of 9, you have it. If you have 5 of 9, you don't. So it's an on-off switch. ADHD occurs along a continuum. It's from 1 to 10. I talk about this in the book. And at the high end of the spectrum, the 9, the 10s, the 10 pluses, that's where you consider medication. But unfortunately, in today's world, we're diagnosing the 5s, the 6s, and the 7s, the mild to moderates. And clearly, it's being done differently state by state.
Right.
So a Louisiana psychiatrist or psychologist, for whatever reason, is more likely to take the same set of criteria and give a diagnosis, whereas in Nevada, they're not. So it's the subjective nature of the diagnostic criteria this calls into question. It's not like a blood test where we can say, oh, you've got it.
Right.
Your genetic profile indicates you've got a 99.5% chance of having an ADHD brain. So, yeah, that's just one more issue that we're dealing with.
So for the parent who's, or for anybody who's listening to you right now, who's thinking or who's been told that ADHD is sort of part of their lives, what's a first step that you want them to take?
Well, the first thing I want them to understand is that ADHD has advantages. I mean, that's once you reframe your thinking from it's all bad, it's a diagnosis, it's a medical disorder that needs to be treated, there's nothing good about it, and change your thinking to saying, okay, so there are disadvantages, but I'm going to be a better multitasker. I can hyper-focus. I have high energy. I'm more resilient. I'm more creative. I can think non-linearly. I have charisma. I'm more athletic. These things then become part of the overall ADHD continuum, I call it.
Okay.
And you can think, all right, well, I've got the bad. What can I do to maximize the good? And I think if I can just get that discussion started with this book,
okay,
then I think the book will be a successful in my mind. I will have done what I set out to do. I'm not looking to change the world. Well, maybe eventually, but I want people
not today.
To put it in the conversation. Understand that when you say the negatives, also understand the positives.
And, you know, the fact is that if we all had the ability to focus on maximizing the good, almost no matter what was going on in our lives, that would change the tenor of the world all by itself.
I think it would. And I think, you know, it was stunning to me that after writing the book, and once again, I've gotten tremendous positive reviews across the board, but there are the naysayers, and I'm always amazed with the naysayers are basically saying there's nothing good about it. It's a medical disorder. You have to take pills and you're making it harder for people to accept that. And, you know, it's bad, 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 bad. I'm going, yeah, but wow. Is your view of the world such that there's no good in any of this, that everything about it is bad? It's like a cancer diagnosis?
Yeah.
I think that's such a narrow and closed-minded view. And I mean, that's one of the things that we're fighting here is they talk about the stigma that I'm lumping on people, making it harder for them to want to take meds. What about the stigma of labeling it as a horrible, terrible curse for life that you're going to be struggling in every aspect as long as you live?
And that you'll never be cured.
Yeah, and unfortunately, and a lot of these people that say, I've had it for 30 years and, you know, have struggled. So it sounds like these folks, and they're taking medicine, and it sounds like they're the worst of the worst. They're probably at the 10-plus edge of the continuum, the most severe symptoms, and it could well be that they do need meds. But the lack of understanding is that everyone who has it is not like you. Everyone is not at that 10-plus realm of the continuum, and why not put a little hope in there? Why not give some positives that this is what you can expect to be good at?
Dr. Archer, I know that this is not the only book that you have created. Is there a website or a way to follow you with your writings, anything like that?
I do have a website, drdalearcher.com. And but I'm also very active on Dr. Dale Archer Facebook page, where I do blogs for Forbes and Psychology Today, a couple of other Mind Body Green, and a couple other health websites. And so everything that I write, I post on Facebook on my professional page. And so oftentimes I'll do small blogs on Facebook itself. So the best way to follow me would be, and what I do would be Facebook and also Twitter. Everything I do, I also put a tweet out about the event. So the website has information on the books. If you're interested about my prior books, it talks about those and some personal information. But for active ongoing updates, then Facebook and Twitter are the way to go.
And what's the Twitter handle?
It's Dr. Dale Archer, DrDaleArcher. And the Facebook professional page is the same thing, DrDaleArcher.
Okay, wonderful. Dr. Archer, thank you very much for joining us today. You've given us a lot to think about. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to take the place of any work you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, send me an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org. And folks, you remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.